Welcome to The Wisdom Show, a gathering place for the world's leading experts in the fields of human potential, spirituality, personal development, health, relationships, and more. Join us as we evolve together to the highest expression of our lives. And now, your host, Jean Swan.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. We are about to hear some amazing insights about both the afterlife and, more importantly, how to really live our lives joyfully here on Earth. Our very special guest has some unique experience with the truth about many of the questions that we all seek answers to. Anita Morjani is the New York Times bestselling author of Dying to Be Me, My Journey from Cancer to Near Death to True Healing. Anita's near-death experience and what she learned from it is beautifully captured in the book. And on the cover of the book, Anita states, "I had the choice to come back or not. I chose to return when I realized that heaven is a state, not a place." Anita, thank you so much for joining us. You're home in Hong Kong to share all of your amazing wisdom with us today.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Anita, in your book, you start by describing your childhood and the beliefs and expectations you felt were placed on you early in your life. And that really set the stage for what was to come later. So can you describe for us what your life was like, what your beliefs were as you were growing up and as you entered adulthood prior to being diagnosed with lymphoma?
Okay. Well, a lot of my childhood, I mean, although a lot of it was actually very magical when I look back now, because I grew up in a very, very culturally mixed society. My parents are Hindu, and at home they tried to bring me up as a Hindu. They taught me about the Hindu way of life and the Indian religion and so on. I went to a British school with mostly British kids, and a lot of them were Christian or Catholics. But I lived in Hong Kong. I've always lived in Hong Kong, which is basically a Chinese, a country inhabited by Chinese people. Although we were a British colony and there were British schools specifically catered for British people, the local people, like the people that lived in my building and a lot of times the kids who I would play with in our neighborhood and in the park, were Chinese kids. And I had a Chinese nanny who had a daughter who was my best friend. And so I grew up in all these different mixed cultures. And what I started to learn as I got older was that different people have different values, and very often these values conflict or contradict each other. For me, that led to a lot of confusion, because it meant that something that was right or true in one culture was not necessarily right or true in another culture, yet the people of that culture would treat those values, or whether it was religious values, cultural values, the people of that culture would treat it as ultimate truth, as though it was absolute truth. And yet once you crossed cultures, you found that value wasn't true anymore. And so I did have a lot of confusion, particularly when talking about, say, for example, religion, religious beliefs of the afterlife. They varied from culture to culture. Also, my parents felt the need to arrange marriage for me, because in Hindu culture, that is something that parents do when they love their children. But when I would talk about it to my Western friends, you know, when I was in my late teens, early 20s, which is around the age when Indian parents start looking for a spouse for their child, for their daughter. So I would talk about it to Western people, and they would wince, and they would say, "Oh my God, your parents still do that? It's prehistoric and it's cruel." And so it was taken in a completely different way as the way, for example, people in my culture would take it. And so there was a lot of this kind of conflict that I had to deal with.
And you also describe in the book how you were at a Catholic school and they would kindly say to you, "Well, you really have to convert." But then at home you were being told something else by your parents. So there was so much conflict in what you were to believe and what you were to live up to. And it really, it sounds like it was really extremely difficult.
Yeah, what I ended up feeling was that I didn't fit in, or I didn't meet the expectations of any culture, because no matter which culture I was moving in, I wasn't quite fitting into that culture. So in the end, it just set me up to always feel like I didn't belong, and I always had to work at trying to fit in, and I never met cultural expectations.
Right, and that even translated into when you had an arranged marriage, which is custom in your culture, but you felt you didn't fit into that mold, and that really wasn't what you wanted in life.
Exactly, and so so when I ran away from the arranged marriage, my reputation, if you will, within our Indian culture was completely shot. It was, I was told by people in our culture that nobody in my culture would now marry me because they were afraid of me and because they thought I was being too picky and because I'd run away and I didn't listen to my parents. And so I was completely ostracized from our Hindu culture for a long time.
And
that, of course, yes.
And then you miraculously met your soulmate. So that was one wonderful outcome that happened, because he embraced you for who you were, not someone who was trying to live up to expectations, but someone who was really living the life that she wanted to live.
Yeah, and I realized that the best thing I did was to run away from that arranged marriage, because here I met somebody who, I mean, he's just amazing, because it was amazing how similar our backgrounds were. And he completely embraced me for who I am. In fact, he liked the fact that I had done that. He admired it, and that made him attracted to me even more.
Right. So that was wonderful, and your life was going along as many of ours do, until you had a couple of people very close to you who were diagnosed with cancer. And that really kind of turned your world around, because you began immersing yourself into finding everything you could about cancer.
Yeah, exactly. Because my best friend was diagnosed with cancer, and that came as a shock to me. And then my husband's brother-in-law was diagnosed with cancer. And I watched these two people who were very close to us, I watched them deteriorate and die. And even though they were having treatment in the best hospitals, in the, you know, the best cancer institutes in the world, and yet they were still deteriorating, and they were having the best treatment that money can actually buy, and they were still deteriorating, and that frightened me very, very much.
So do you feel, looking back now, that the attention that you paid to the cancer and the energy that you put into learning about it and changing your diet and trying to stay away from it is really what caused it to happen?
Yes, in huge ways, yes, it is. I believe that it was the fear, it was the incredible fear, and it's generally always living my life from the fear, the fearful perspective. Everything from growing up and fearing religion, cultures, fearing that I'm always doing wrong. And the same when I saw the cancer, I saw it manifest in my best friend, and I watched, I was with her, and I saw it so closely every day, and I just feared every day that if this can happen to her, then it can happen to me. And so I started researching all the time. I just wanted to, everything I did was to avoid having cancer. It was because I wanted to avoid going through what she was going through and what my husband's brother-in-law was going through. And so I would just research and read up on everything that caused cancer, and I started to believe that microwaves cause cancer, plastic containers, mobile phones, and all kinds of foods, like foods with hormones and genetically modified foods. So I started eating really organic, and I was drinking wheatgrass juice every day, and I was growing my own wheatgrass, and I wasn't doing it from a place of love, like it wasn't, it's all right to eat healthy, but I wasn't doing it from a place of a desire to be healthy. It was more a place of fear that if I don't do this, I'm going to get cancer.
Right, so it's like the fear overrides whatever you do, whatever your choices are.
Exactly.
The fear is going to be the overpowering force in your life that is not going to attract what you want, but it, in your case, it attracted cancer.
Exactly. It was, in fact, my energy was focused on what I didn't want. Everything that was driving my action, my everyday actions, decisions, they were all being driven by the fear of what I didn't want rather than by the desire of what I wanted.
So at one point while you were sick, you embraced Ayurvedic medicine in India, and you said you were improving, but it was so fascinating because you said you didn't believe that it was the form of treatment itself, but it was more the environment, the mindset that you were in and that people were in embracing that you would heal and that they weren't so fearful about cancer.
Yeah, that helped me so much because I got out of that fear-based mindset. And also, the one thing that's actually really hard for me to admit is that being removed from the environment where I was watching my friends deteriorate every day, and I was removed from that environment of being in the hospital with her all the time and watching her deteriorate, and I was in a completely different environment. I was in an ashram where people looked at illnesses completely differently. That had huge benefit for me, and it's actually very hard for me to admit that because I felt that I was being there for my friend when I was here in Hong Kong and I was in the hospital as much as I was able to, but being in that environment and her cancer was far more advanced than mine, and watching her go through what she was going through and watch her not get better and just get worse and being in the hospital every day, and knowing that I had a cancer diagnosis, that was really, really detrimental for me. And so being removed from that environment in itself was a benefit for me personally. I know many people are strong enough to handle being able to deal with that, but at that point in my life where I was with my fears and everything, I wasn't strong enough to handle it. And yet I felt I needed to be there for my friend. And so when I was in this ashram, the environment was just so different, and the way that everybody around me viewed illness was just so different that in itself had a huge impact on me and my mind and my well-being, my emotional and mental well-being. And then on top of that, it was the yoga and the food and the diet and everything.
And you mentioned how the mindset is so different in Hong Kong as it is in the United States, where there is so much fear about cancer, and that feeds into the problem and the additional diagnoses. And when people aren't so focused and fearful about it, then there is less of it, you found, right?
Absolutely. Because one of the things, I mean, where I live here in Hong Kong, there's a lot of there's a lot of contrast in that because we have a mix of Western and Eastern. So if we immerse ourselves like we have absolutely fully developed allopathic, like Western hospitals, which are as good as what you would get in the West, in the United States, or anywhere. And so once we immerse ourselves into that system, I found that I was feeling very, very fearful, and it's almost like you just absorb the energy of what is what people believe around cancer in those systems. It was like you're being told that the only path you can take is that of chemotherapy and radiation, but at the same time, you know that in Western medicine, people are constantly saying we still have not got a cure for cancer. People are still researching the cure for cancer. Whereas if I was following traditional Chinese medicine, which they call TCM, is a very, very different way they treat cancer, because cancer is seen as an imbalance in your body. And it's also seen as something which they consider as a disease of excess, of having too much of something. And again, in Ayurveda, in the Indian system, it's seen as something, again, yet completely different. So, but the fear around it was the most when I was in Western hospitals.
Right, and you say that the approach of let's attack the disease and get rid of it was the least helpful approach that you experienced.
Oh, absolutely, because the approach of seeing it as some kind of external enemy that's kind of attacked your body, and then feeling that
you're attacking something, getting rid of it. You're fighting war with it. You're racing against it. It's you against the cancer, and you've got to be faster at fighting it. Otherwise, it's going to kill you. That whole approach, I found, is not helpful at all. It's probably the worst approach, because what I later understood is that the cancer is your own body's way of communicating with you, and it has to be listened to, and it has to be understood, and we have to work with it, not against it.
Right, and that, well, after that experience of healing somewhat in India, then you went back to Hong Kong, and then once again, your cancer accelerated, right?
Yes, exactly, because I went back into that environment, and after I was back in Hong Kong for a short time, I was back in the environment of visiting my friend, and then she actually died, which was a huge blow to me. It was really huge, and then all the attention came on to me from everybody, because we were in the same circle of friends, and a lot of people started asking me what I was doing, you know, where, what stage was my cancer at and what I was doing with it. And they said that, you know, be sensible about it. A lot of people sensed that I was very fearful, and they said, oh, don't be fearful. You've got to deal with it. You don't want to go through what she went through. And I was saying, exactly, I don't want to go through what she went through, which is why I want to deal with it differently. And they were saying, no, you better go for a scan and see. And also most of the people who opt for the normal Western medicine tend not to believe in alternatives. So with a lot of people telling me that, oh, these Ayurvedic things, they're only temporary, they don't work permanently, you better have it checked. And so I noticed the fear was coming back in full force, and especially since now my friend had also died, and I just felt this was the fate that awaited me. I just felt that, okay, I can't, I'm not going to be able to fight this.
So you got to the point where, just so people understand how miraculous your recovery was, your organs shut down, you were brought to the hospital, your family was told that you didn't have much time left. That's how severe the cancer was in your body at that point. Can you describe what happened when you went to the hospital and then you felt you went into the coma and had this life-altering experience?
Sure. I mean, by this point, where I was at was my lungs were filled with fluid and I was on oxygen. By this point, I weighed about 85 pounds because my muscles had completely deteriorated. And I couldn't walk anymore. I was lying in bed all the time, and I was choking, constantly choking and coughing because my lungs were filled with fluid. And I had a low-grade fever. I had open skin lesions. I had tumors the size of lemons from the base of my skull all around my neck, under my arms and my chest, all down to my abdomen. And then on the morning of February the 2nd, I didn't wake up. I was in a coma. And my husband rushed me to the hospital, and at that point the doctor said that these were my final hours because my organs had now shut down. And what they didn't know, though, was that I was fully aware of everything that was happening all around me.
And you were even aware of things not even in the same room, things happening with your brother at
yes.
a distance. You had an awareness that went beyond, way beyond the room that you were in.
Oh, yes. In fact, I had 360-degree vision. It was like I could see all around me, and it was as though my consciousness was just spilling way out of my body and expanding, like way beyond my body, beyond the room I was in, even beyond the hospital I was in, because I started to become aware that my brother, who was in India at the time, I became aware that he was rushing to get on a flight to come and see me. And I could feel what he was feeling, that he was in despair, like he wanted to get there before I actually died, because he was aware I was dying, and I could feel his feeling, and I felt I need to hold on, I need to stay alive till he gets here, because he and I are very close, and I didn't want him to get there and see that I'd already passed away. And I was aware of everything that was happening in the hospital, the conversations my husband was having with the doctor, even the conversations taking place well beyond earshot outside of the room where I was. And then I became aware of my father, who had passed away 10 years prior. I became aware of his presence, and I became aware of the presence of my best friend, who I'd lost to cancer. And all I felt from my father was unconditional love, even though when I was growing up, my relationship with him had been quite turbulent because I was always rebelling against our culture, and I had rebelled against the arranged marriage, and so my father and I had had a turbulent relationship, and now all I felt from him in the other realm was unconditional love, and I felt like as though I just completely understood why he'd done everything he'd done. I understood that even when he had arranged the marriage for me, that it was the only way he knew how to show love for me. And then I completely understood that in our culture, it's done when you love your daughter, and if he didn't push me to do it, he felt that he wasn't taking care of me. And that level of understanding that it came from a place of love, that only came when I was with him in the other realm, where I just felt that I could feel everything he was feeling. And it's like in that realm, it's like our essences just merge, and there's no room for misinterpreting the intentions of the other person.
Some of the things you write about,
it was just the most amazing
thing. It was so amazing reading about it. And you write, you answer so many of the questions that we have about life and death, and things that have been taught in recent years. Well, they've been taught for ages in spiritual practices, but they have come to people's awareness quite a bit in recent years. One thing that you say you learned and felt is that there is no separation between us. This is a concept that we hear, but living in the physical reality, a lot of us have a hard time understanding that. How did that come to you, that there is no separation and we really are all one?
I felt that I, as though I could feel what every single person was feeling. It was like we're all connected, and like I could feel what every doctor and nurse was feeling who was working on me. I could feel their resignation, their fear. I could feel what my husband was feeling, and I knew our purpose was linked. I could feel what my brother was feeling and my mother. It was as though when we're not with our physical bodies, and there's no separation, there's no biology, there's no physicalness to keep us separate. So the essence that expresses through our physical bodies, your essence, my essence, all of our essences are all connected. And when you're in that realm, you realize that it really doesn't make sense to kill other people off, because we are all just expressions of the same essence. It just makes no sense whatsoever. It's like, you know, like fingers on the same hand seeing each other as being separate, but they're all part of the same hand. And imagine if one finger started to destroy another or kill the other finger off, another finger. That's what it feels like in that realm that we are doing when we're in the physical.
Right, you talk about in the physical how we have jails, and we think of criminals as them against us, but that there is none of that in the other realm, and no need for that.
There's no them and us. There's absolutely no them and us. It's all us. It's all us as one whole consciousness allowing these things to happen. And for us to eliminate it, what I felt I understood is that it takes a greater awareness from all of us. You know, it takes awareness. Every single one of us is responsible for sharing this awareness of realizing that we're all in this together, that we are all brothers and sisters. We need to love each other and help each other and forgive each other and see the need for the jails and the rise in crime as a cry for help from the whole, not as, oh God, we got to put those guys in jail. And what it does is that it creates more fear. We can't fight fear with fear, but that's what we're doing. We need to actually embrace everybody and love everyone and realize that, okay, as a whole, all of us together, we're all in it together. We've created this reality, this consciousness that we live in, this fear-based reality. We've created it together, so now let's try something different.
So, Anita, for those of us who have not had near-death experiences, how can you help us to understand how to experience this feeling of that we are all connected? In other words, you experienced that with your near-death experience, but for the rest of us, how can we achieve fully understanding and experiencing that? Is there a way you can help us to live in that state more?
Yes, I believe I can. And what but I try to make it really, really simple, first of all, because I believe that the reason why we don't feel this connection with each other is because all of us are living from a place of fear. It's almost like it's been conditioned in us from the time that we're children. I believe that we're born with this feeling of connection and born with this feeling of trust and love, and it's like inbuilt, but we have it conditioned out of us. And the way that it's been conditioned out of us is that from the time we're really little, we're taught in schools to compete with each other, with other kids, because we've got to always be better than other kids. You know, the way we're graded in school, all our school lessons and plans, we have to get an A, we have to, and how are we judged as having an A? Or it's because it's all, everything is done by comparison.
So right, yes.
Yeah, and so we always feel separate. We're taught from the time we're young that we've got to be better than the other kids. We've got to be number one. And that means that everyone else has to be number two, three, and four. So here we have, from the time we're young, knowing that, okay, I've got to get an A. The way that it's even determined that you have an A is by taking the top mark of what is capable in that age group, which means you know you've got to get ahead of the other kids. And that's been inbuilt into us, conditioned into us, to a point where we don't even realize it's there. And we carry it with us, this need to compete and to fight and to get ahead and to see ourselves as better than other people. So if we really wanted to make some radical changes, we'd have to start changing it from our education system and make the better values, values of collaboration and cooperation rather than competition. But at the moment, the world is built on competition, not on collaboration. So what I tell people as individuals, what we need to do every single day when we wake up in the morning is to ask ourselves, every choice that we're making, are we making it from a place of fear or from a place of love? And when I say a place of love, it means a love for ourselves, a love for our lives, a love for the people around us. So when we choose our choice of work, are we choosing it because we fear if we don't work at this or we don't choose this career, we're going to be losers, seen as losers? Or are we choosing these jobs and careers because it's what we want to do, it's what we love to do, it's what we have a passion for doing? And so it's the same with everything we choose, whether we're choosing our clothes, the car we drive, the people we hang out with, the foods we eat. Are we doing it because it enhances us, it makes us feel good, it brings us joy? Or are we choosing these things because we are fearful that if we don't choose it, we fear the consequences? So I start asking people to become aware of that, and that's really the very first step, is to make your choices in life from a place of joy. What you'll find is that as your life, your own personal life, becomes more joyful, when you become aware that the choices you're making are from a place of joy and you start doing that and your life becomes joyful, you'll find that you will encourage other people around you to also find joy. You will be a joy to be around. And the more joyful you are, the more you start to spread that joy, and then the more generous and connected you feel. And, I mean, a shorter way is to do it through meditation, but so many people come to me and say they don't know how to meditate.
And when you meditate, what meditation does is that it pauses your thoughts, and it allows the messages to come through. It allows the messages from your higher self to communicate with you. When you live in joy, you are connected to your higher self all the time. And personally, I prefer living my life from joy all the time rather than living a hectic life and then finding 20 minutes a day to meditate. So I actually prefer the living in joy method, because that's what I do. Ever since my near-death experience, for me, it just kind of happened. The switch was made, but this is what I tell people to do. And really, it's something everybody can do. If you start just becoming aware of why you're making your choices, and you start to consciously choose to live and make your choices from joy rather than fear every single day, you will notice that you are so much more connected to your higher self. When you're connected to your higher self, you're connected to that oneness that connects to all of us.
I love how you talk about living in joy, because don't you think a lot of people don't give themselves permission to be in joy? They think, well, it's not virtuous, or I need to have a spiritual practice, or I need to try harder, I need to do more, I need to be more. People, and I know I've been guilty of this, don't give themselves permission to have joy a lot
Absolutely.
Of the time.
And there's always a reason. We always give ourselves a reason. It could be something like a loved one is sick, or somebody is suffering, and people feel, oh, if there are starving people in the world, then I don't deserve to be happy, and I need to be out there doing something about it. But if every single person consciously chose to live in joy, we wouldn't allow there to be starving people, or we would be out there uplifting people so that people wouldn't be in fear or desperation to commit crimes. So it starts first with ourselves, because if you're living in a state of fear and guilt, that's all that you're going to have to share with everyone else. So it starts with loving yourself enough to give yourself permission to be in joy regardless of what's happening around you. And only when you allow yourself to live in joy will you be in a position to touch other people with your joy, who will then in turn each live in joy and touch those around them.
There is just so much wisdom in this book, that being one major part of it. I mean, I have just pages and pages of notes, because almost everything you say about what you learned is such a profound teaching for us. And you say that you realizing that you are love was the most important lesson you learned, and that allowed you to release the fear, and that was the key that saved your life, realizing that you are love.
Yeah, most of us don't dare be ourselves, because that's the other thing, is that when you live in joy, you allow yourself to be who you are. Most of us are afraid that if we give ourselves and we give the people around us permission to be who they are, we'd all run havoc. There would be mayhem. Actually, that's not the case. Why do we assume that there's going to be mayhem if there's no restriction or control in allowing ourselves to be who we are? In fact, there's already mayhem and havoc in the world, and we're so fearful. And what I realize is that when I allow myself to truly be who I am is someone more loving than who I am when I restrict myself. And so I realize that who we are at our core is love, and we're blocking it off.
And you say that in the book, our only obligation in this life is to be true to ourselves and to allow, and that when we do this, everything that's truly ours comes to us effortlessly. I love that. That is, if we could all live like that, our lives would be wonderful.
It's exactly true. We don't need to compete and chase, and we don't need to feel like we need to get ahead of the next person. None of that is necessary, and yet we live like, you know, we've created a rat race. But it doesn't need to be, because when your only obligation is to be who you are, there's no one to compete with, because there's only one of you. You just got to be yourself and just become aware of your uniqueness and express it. That's all.
So you really make it very simple and fun, which is contrary to what a lot of us believe the way it is when we're connecting with ourselves or being spiritual. So what is your feeling about religions and spiritual practices at this point? Are they necessary? Because I think in the book, you're more tapped into the joy than you are into any processes of spirituality.
Yeah, for me, the most important thing is to have a joyful life, because I feel your life is your prayer. And if having religion or a spiritual practice, if having something ritualistic is what you need, and if it uplifts you, and if it's what keeps you going, then by all means do it. But many of us practice rituals out of fear, the fear that if we don't do it, we're not spiritual enough, or we're not going to get to this place in the afterlife. That's absolutely useless, because life is not supposed to be fearful. If anything is fearful, anything related to being spiritual or religious is fearful, then either you've misinterpreted it or you're not doing it right, then just drop it. Just drop it. You are so much better off just doing what makes you joyful. It makes you a better person to be around, and it makes your life better. It makes you more uplifting. And what I do is I'm not into rituals myself, and I just live a life where I just do what brings me joy. And I know that my life, or our lives here, the life itself is a prayer. And having fun and laughing is far more therapeutic than any religious ritual or anything. Many of our religions take life far too seriously. And I don't think it's the religion itself, but I think it's the way many of us have interpreted our religions. So, and also, I don't believe that any one religion has it completely right, or any one religion is more superior over any other. So that's why I will never label my experience with a religion, with any one religion. I've been exposed to so many. I wouldn't want to ostracize any religion. I like to think that death transcends religion, and it does, because religion is actually a here thing. It's part of our physical reality. It's part of our culture. But once we die, we transcend everything that's here. We're all one. It doesn't matter whether you're a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew or a Hindu. It really doesn't matter when we're in the other realm. We're all together there.
And you say there is no judgment there. A lot of people feel, well, there's going to be judgment day, and I'm going to have to explain a lot of things I've done in my life. But you say none of that exists in the other realm.
No, because we wake up. We completely wake up, and we completely understand why we did everything we did. We understand why everyone else did what they did, because even people that have harmed us, we can feel what they're feeling. We feel the fear they felt that caused them to do that. Even when we harm people, we do it out of fear. We do it out of a feeling of being lost and alone and fearful. So coming from a place of being fearful, there isn't even more punishment waiting for us. I mean, if you believe, it's just totally unconditional. I mean, if you are a parent, and if your child is fearful, and no matter what they do wrong, you're not going to punish them when they do things out of fear and pain and sorrow, and they act out, you're not going to punish them even more after they've done it. And when we get to the other side, we realize ourselves, and we kind of wake up to this feeling that, oh my God, I did that. And then I was feeling fearful. Oh gosh, I harmed all these people. And there isn't some God waiting to put us into hell or something to punish us for what we've done wrong. No, there's complete awareness of why we did what we did.
And for people living in this physical realm, that can be a little hard to understand, because everyone thinks that people should pay for their crimes, a murderer shouldn't get away with murder. From what you're saying, we're at such a different level of understanding in the other realm that we don't need that anymore.
Yeah, we don't. We really don't. And it's, you know, we believed that years, but has it reduced the crime rate? No, it hasn't.
Right.
And you know, we believe for years that we're going to get punished, we're going to get bad karma, we're going to go to hell, or whatever it is that we believe in, but I'm afraid that's not the case. There's only compassion, love, awareness awaiting for us on the other side.
And you chose to come back. A lot of people who have near-death experiences say that it was hard for them to come back. Sometimes they did it because they had children to come back to, or they felt they didn't complete what they came on Earth to do. Why is it that you made the choice? You said you had the choice, and you decided to come back to the physical realm.
At first, I didn't want to come back either because it was so amazing in the other side. It was the harder choice was to come back. But I also, it was because my father said to me that it wasn't my time, even though I had the choice. But I also then understood that I hadn't completed my purpose. And I also, one of the reasons I didn't want to come back was because my body was so sick. I thought if I came back, it would just be more suffering for me and more suffering for my family who were caring for me. But then I became aware of why I got the cancer. I just completely, in that state of awareness, that state of being so awake, I understood everything that had happened in my life. I understood how I had got to that point of being in that hospital bed, how every decision, every choice I'd made in my life up to that point led me to being there, and I understood why I had the cancer. And then I understood that if I chose to go back, now that I knew what I knew, my cancer would heal very, very rapidly. And it was with that understanding that my father said to me that now that you know the truth of who you really are, go back and live your life fearlessly.
Right, and you have completely changed the way you live your life. Why do you think, you know, we come into this physical experience, and a lot of people believe that we are souls who make the conscious choice to come here, but then oftentimes it seems we forget why we're here, and then, you know, so why do you think we do incarnate into these physical bodies, and do you think we make the choice to do that?
I think we do. I think we make the choice to incarnate into these physical bodies, and we do it to experience. We do it to really to just experience different facets of life. And I feel that it doesn't matter whether you have a short life or a long life. People who pass away, they've lived their purpose. They've experienced what they needed to experience. And sometimes we do it for ourselves, sometimes even for the people around us. If we exit early, nobody that's exited has exited at an imperfect time for that soul and for the people around us, even though it may feel that way for those around us. And I believe that it's purely to experience. So whether we come as people with, you know, with if we're autistic or if we're paraplegic, we still come to experience that for ourselves and the people around us. And it adds to the spectrum of emotions that we feel. We don't get to feel this kind of duality and these kinds of emotions in the other realm.
So do you feel that, what are your thoughts about karma and past lives? Another fascinating thing you talk about is how you experienced all of time happening simultaneously, which is what is taught in quantum physics. But for us in the physical realm, it's a very hard concept to understand. But you got an understanding of how everything is happening at once.
Yeah, I felt in the other realm that, you know, I was aware of what I could interpret as past lives, but the way that I was watching them unfold before me was, it was as though it was happening right here, right now. So I was watching what was happening in my present life. I was aware of the both possibilities of my future, like I had the choice that if I chose to die, I was aware of what would happen next if I died. I was aware of what would happen next if I chose life, but I was aware of other lifetimes that I'd lived. But all of it looked like it was happening simultaneously. None of it felt like past or present or future. I mean, they were all, it just depended where my focus was. If I put my focus on a past life, that's what I was watching unfold. If I put my focus on the future of this life where I was dying of cancer, that's what I saw unfold. I saw that if I chose to come back, this is what I had in store for me. And it was as though everything was happening simultaneously. And my understanding now is that it's as though when we're living in the physical and processing through our mind, we can only process one point of time at a time. And then we link all these points of time together to create linear time in our mind. But in actuality, when we're not using our own mind and brain to process, when I was just pure consciousness, it was as though I could be anywhere in space and time at any time. And so it didn't matter where in space, that means distance didn't matter and time didn't matter. My consciousness could be everywhere all at once. And it just depended where I put my awareness.
So amazing. And again, another teaching of quantum physics that I want to read a quote that you have in the book, which it shows how you experience what a lot of us have been taught, but we don't have an understanding of. You wrote, "The tapestry of time is already woven and everything we want already exists. So we need to expand our own consciousness to allow universal energy to bring it into reality here." So you're saying all the possibilities exist. And once we expand our consciousness, we can have what it is we choose.
Exactly. And also I gave the metaphor of the warehouse. It's like if you imagine you're inside a huge warehouse and the lights are off and all you've got is one torchlight and you're shining the beam of your torchlight and there's only very, very little that you can see. Maybe you can only see one thing at a time, which your torchlight is shining on. And so you think that everything, what you see, is all that exists. But imagine if somebody turns the floodlights on and these big lights go on and the whole warehouse is lit up and you realize that it's an incredibly huge warehouse. You can't even see the end of it. It's so huge. And there are these rows and rows of shelves stocked up, chock full of stuff, some of which you knew existed because maybe your torch had shone on it before, but most of it you never even knew existed. But there it is. It's right there on these shelves, all these things that you never even knew could even exist, different colors that you've never experienced before, maybe different emotions, feelings, scenarios. You see them all stocked on the shelves. So even when the light goes off and you're back to one torchlight, you realize that there's so much out there that exists even though you can't see it. That means all possibilities exist all at the same time. Even though your torchlight, your life, is only shining on one possibility in this moment, in this point in time, everything exists simultaneously. And we tend to believe that what our torchlight is shining on is the only truth there is, but that's not the case. If we kind of let go and diffuse ourselves and allow, we can allow just about anything to come into our life because it all exists simultaneously. We try to control our experiences with our mind. That's like controlling where the beam is going to shine. And sometimes when we use too much control, we limit our experience. We limit what's going to come in. But if we kind of let go, and if the more we let go, maybe we can kind of start to see in the dark and we can start to see some of the other things out there and we can move our torchlight broader and wider and come across things that we didn't even know existed and allow them into our reality.
So you confirm in your experience another thing that, you know, we've been taught is that we are co-creators with our thoughts, emotions, and actions. That's another thing that sometimes it's hard to for people to understand or to live by in this physical realm, that, you know, a lot of people live their lives thinking things happen to them and they react and that's it. But so what you're saying is, you know, that one flashlight, that is what we're choosing to focus on and that's what we're creating, right?
Yes, exactly. That one flashlight is what we are focused on, but that's not all of reality. We can focus on something different, and sometimes we can just let go. Now, what I tell people is that you know, our minds need to be occupied with something, otherwise they'll go and find something to fear. So focus on something that brings you joy. Consciously focus on something that brings you joy. And if that's your mantra, if that's the only ritual you have, you're set up for a really great life.
I love that. I feel good when you say that. it feels really happy and light and joyful. And it sounds like, wow, I really want to live like that. That's incredible. I mean, and it's so simple, so much more simple than we make it, don't you think?
Oh, it is much more simple. We make it so complicated. And I don't understand why spiritual practices or religious practices need to be so complicated. They don't. We can get rid of all the hierarchy within religion and all the different rituals and just make it simple for ourselves. Get rid of all the fear and everything. Just make it really simple, and your only mantra needs to be focus on what brings you joy, and that's it. It's as simple as that.
And you also talk about how, again, on the theme of living from the inside out rather than the outside in, that you learned in your near-death experience, along those lines, you also say that what we experience is mirroring what we're feeling inside. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, most of us react to what's on the outside. We see what's on the outside and we take that as real. We think everything out in the physical is the real world, and our feelings and emotions are reacting to that. And we think that when we can change the outside and when we can control it a certain way, then eventually we will be happy. That's actually so opposite. When you can find joy on the inside, your outside world will reflect it. Right now, if your outside world is a mess, it's because it's a reflection of what you're feeling inside. It is so the other way around, and we have it. We are taught from really young to see the outside world as the reality, and we get accordingly. We see glimpses of happiness when things fall into place once in a while, and most of the time we feel frustration because we can't control what's happening on the outside, but we think that we need to control it. But it is just so the other way around. All we need to do is go inward, ask ourselves, what brings me joy? Follow your joy, and you'll find your outside world will start to fall into place.
So it sounds like what you're saying in your book is that most of us view this earthly physical reality as the real reality, but it's almost as if you're saying this is the dream and beyond this is the real reality.
Yes, exactly. Because when I woke up in my near-death experience state, I mean, for the outside world, it looked like I was in a coma. But for me, internally, it was like I woke up to the real world. When people ask me, oh, how do you know it wasn't a dream? How do you compare it to your dreams? Dreams, you know they dream. After a time, they fade. You know, after a few days, even a really, really powerful dream, after a few weeks, you can barely remember it. This is very, very different. This was like I woke up, and it felt like life is a dream, and that was reality. And it doesn't fade. It's like a door that never closes. It changes you and makes you a different person and takes you down a different path, so that you're never the same again, ever. And that's actually what I tried to do in writing my book. I wanted for people who read it to actually change and not see life the same way again after they read the book.
The book is incredible. I would recommend it to everyone listening and all their friends and family, because all of these questions that we all ponder about life, about death, about the afterlife, about reality, you answer them. And it's really comforting because you make it all much simpler than we make it. You make it understandable. You kind of, on many of the points, I felt relieved because these are things I believed, but then there might be a part of me saying, well, is that really true? You know? And when I, you know, and then you experience, I say, aha, okay, that is the truth. That's what it does for us, I think, in this realm, is it gives us a little more concrete understanding of a lot of these issues.
Oh, I'm so glad, because I want people to know these things. I want people to know that their loved ones who have passed on are fine, more than fine. They're happy, they're free, they're liberated. I want people to know that, you know, that if their loved one passed on, if they didn't come back, it doesn't mean that they don't love them enough. our loved ones always, if it's their time, it's their time. They don't have a choice. If they had a choice, they will make the more unconditionally loving choice. And also, if we start to find joy again when our loved ones pass on, don't feel guilty, because your loved ones would be happy if you moved on and found joy again. They don't want you to bereave for them. They don't want you to spend your life grieving. They don't want you to feel guilty. They want to see you happy, and nothing will make them happier than to see you happy again. Some people feel guilty if they laugh or have fun when they've lost a loved one. Don't feel guilty. It's what they want for you, and people need to know that. They need to know that it's okay to find your joy again when you've lost somebody.
I think it gives a lot of people comfort that you did see your father and your friends on the other side, and that they are there and they welcomed you. And I think people have a lot of comfort in that, because that is one of the biggest questions people want to know. Will they see their loved ones again?
They will. They will absolutely see their loved ones. But I also tell people, you can talk to your loved ones even now. And some people feel guilt because they didn't say, I love you, or they didn't say certain things, or things were left unsaid, or they didn't apologize. You can say it now. They can hear you. Just say it now. Talk to them as if they're there. Continue to talk to them as if they're there. And you don't have to feel guilty. They know what you're feeling. If you're feeling really, really sad and sorry that you didn't say something, they know it. Tell them now, and they want you to be happy, and it's important that people know this.
And on the whole idea of that we are all connected and not separate, another important point that you make in the book is that we can really affect the whole planet with our own actions and loving ourselves. A lot of people look at loving ourselves as selfish, but you're saying that self-love is really the basis of turning our life, you know, creating the best lives for ourselves and our world. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. When you love yourself, then only do you have love to give other people, because when you're empty inside, you don't have anything to give anybody else. It starts with loving yourself. What we've got completely wrong and upside down is we've been taught, and we continue to teach, that it's selfish to love yourself and it's egotistical to love yourself. On the contrary, the people who are come across as being the most selfish or egotistical are the ones who are overcompensating because they don't love themselves enough. When you love yourself, you are actually the most loving person to be around, because you automatically become generous, because you have a lot of love to share. And one of the basis of our dysfunctional relationships is that we are taught to give and give of ourselves. And what we do is we give and give and give. And when it doesn't come back to us, we start to resent the people that we're giving to. But when we learn that it's okay to love ourselves, we don't resent other people, because we don't become needy. We don't need anything from them. And in fact, when we fill ourselves so full that we're overflowing with love, all we have for other people is love, and we just give it freely with no expectation. We can only be unconditionally loving towards others when we are first unconditionally loving towards ourselves. The other thing we tend to teach people is to love your neighbor as you love yourself. Well, if you don't love yourself, then that's not a very good policy, is it?
Right.
And that's probably why our world is so messed up, because people are so hungry inside, and they're so lost, and they're so fearful. When you love yourself, there's no room for fear, because when you love yourself, the next thing that comes is trust. You start trusting. You start trusting in your choices. You allow yourself to feel joy, and then you start trusting in the process of the universe, because with love comes trust. And what gets moved out of the way is fear. When you have love, you don't have fear. The more love you have, the less fear you have. There's no room inside for both. It's one or the other. So love tends to replace fear. So it's really, really important to have self-love. And people who love themselves, who are happy, who find their joy, do not go around hurting other people. And that's why it's really important.
And another point you make in the book is you say that the problems in the world are not from hatred or judgment we have toward others, but that we have toward ourselves, going back again to self-love.
Yes, yes, and that's exactly the problem. The people who are the most judgmental towards others are actually the very ones who are most judgmental towards themselves. And when we stop judging ourselves, when we start being kinder to ourselves, when we start relaxing about who we are, and when we become more comfortable with being who we are so much kinder to other people and less judgmental towards other people. It really starts with the self.
Anina, you've said so many profound things today that are really exciting and hopeful, I think, for a lot of people. What is the most important message that you really want people to take away from our time with you today? If you could sum it up for us, what is the most important thing that you are really here to tell the world?
I want people to know that you are amazing, beautiful, magnificent. You really are, but you just don't realize it. Many of us who go in search of trying to be more spiritual, and we go in search. I mean, you look at the sales of self-help books, they're incredibly high, and it's because we all think we're not good enough. I want people to know that you are. You just need to realize it. You need to wake up to it. You don't need anything outside of yourself to make you more, to make you better. You really are perfect, beautiful, amazing, magnificent. You just have to allow yourself to be yourself. And the way to do that is to do what brings you joy, because being in your state of joy is what connects you to who you are. Live your life with joy. Your life is your prayer, and laugh. Don't take yourself seriously. Laugh at yourself a lot and have fun.
That is such great advice, Anita. Thank you so much for sharing your incredible near-death experience with us, for enlightening us on so many issues about life and death. Thank you for being with us today. We totally enjoyed having you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And Anita's book is called Dying to Be Me, My Journey from Cancer to Near Death to True Healing. You'll find it everywhere that books are sold, and you can also go to Anita's website, anitamorjani.com, anitamorjani.com. Visit Anita's website for lots more insights, videos, and information about her experience. Thanks to everyone joining us. We hope we'll take this incredible information and all create joyful lives. We look forward to sharing more possibilities with you next time on The Wisdom Show.
Thanks for joining us. Be sure to visit us at thewisdomshow.com for access to archives of previous shows and special discount packages offered by our world-renowned experts. Thanks to InternetAudioHub.com for our state-of-the-art broadcast sound. InternetAudioHub.com is available for all of your internet audio needs. We look forward to joining you next time on The Wisdom Show.